In these times of divisiveness, I was curious about a book on wonder. It would be helpful to all of us. So I tracked down Doug Cosper, the author of On Wings of Wonder. I found him at the Carousel in Nederland.
So I understand one of the butterflies is here.
Mira. She's got big, beautiful blue wings, just as the character in the book. And she's got tufts of fur on the top of her head where Case would hold on and ride her. And those are the antenna, and you can see that they seem to glow already.
Oh, yeah, right.
And my favorite is the yellow scarf, the woolen yellow scarf.
Scott enjoyed the story on Wings of Wonder and set out to carve her.
Now, Scott's the craftsman that carved all of these wonderful wooden animals that make up the carousel.
Scott Harrison, absolutely. And he worked at least probably more than 40 years to carve all those animals and assemble an old 1910 carousel.
So Mira is such an interesting character because she has a more female transformation.
Yeah, Mira is a newly fledged wonder keeper, and she's the size of a other carousel animal. She's probably about 4 or 5 feet long, and she's got this beautiful, beautiful set of blue wings. Her body is golden, and she's got a proboscis on which she feasts on butterfly bush.
Yes, and these bulging eyes, which are just so wonderful to symbolize a creature full of curiosity and fantasy and awe at the world.
Those are compound eyes, of course, and I learned in the course of research for this book that butterflies can see color spectra that we can't see.
Yet we learned so much science in this book, which is fascinating because it's also a page-turner. And yet you get so much history, geography, sociology, and science.
Part of the joy of writing is growing. I have a former student. She lives in Botswana. She's Ghanaian, and she's an author as well. She taught me long ago, you write to discover yourself, not to entertain anyone. And that's sort of what I did here. Did you know that butterflies taste with their feet?
We learned that in the book. I had no idea.
Absolutely. And Flinder is very fond of mud. And it took Case a while. Case is the main character. He's 12 years old. And his parents own the Carousel of Happiness in Nederland. And he works there sometimes. Well, Case's mom is a lepidopterist, a butterfly scientist. And she has disappeared on a secret mission to who knows where. And no one knows where she is. No one knows where to find her. It's all very mysterious. And Case is a curious 12-year-old, and he's wondering, like most, what on earth he's here on the earth to do. And he's wondering whether he shouldn't be doing something else or belong somewhere else. And when his mom disappears, he focuses entirely on finding her.
Which is such a wonderful frame in which to have a coming-of-age story, where he discovers so much more, such as his values and what he respects and the direction his life is going to go. But he does it in a way that brings us all along with him.
Nice, thank you. He's a very naive young man. He does live in Colorado, and he hasn't traveled much yet, and he is about to discover 12-year-olds whose lives have been, unfortunately, extremely, extremely different than his. Would you like to hear a bit of first time Case meets Flinder?
Let's have a reading.
I should say that Case had just gotten into a fight, which is very uncharacteristic for him, with a kid that was making fun of him and claiming that his mother ran away from the family and deserted them in Nederland, and Case lost it and punched him in the nose.
Yeah, he takes on such middle school issues like bullying.
Yeah. It was cold inside when he reached the house. Case washed the dried blood off his hand and checked the firewood bin. Empty. The back door opened onto a pleasant space. The butterfly garden, a few steps away from the door, was full purple blooms. Case loved that garden. It had given him countless hours of bug and bird watching. A few paces beyond the garden, the season's dwindling firewood stack was still as tall as Case. George wasn't the handiest dad in town, but he loved to split firewood, that and knit. Case filled his arms with split logs.
"Excuse me, partner," a voice came behind him. Startled that someone had managed to sneak up on him like that, Case spun around. A log dropped to the ground. Case froze. His mouth fell open. The whole load tumbled from his arms. There, standing on all four legs next to the purple butterfly bush, was a butterfly. An enormous butterfly. A really enormous butterfly. And blue, with shiny black eyes. An enormous, splendid blue butterfly, four times Case's height, with its wings folded up, was standing there in the garden between Case and the back door. Case thought his heart would burst out of his chest. He bent down and picked up a sturdy log and held it menacingly. He was afraid for Maddie, who sat calmly and watched the creature, her tail wagging a welcome. "You know which way is west, partner?" Case struggled to regain his senses. His gut told him to flee this impossible creature. But the question was a reasonable one. "Butterflies don't have mouths," Case said in a loud whisper. "But you are talking, and you are talking like a cowboy from a Western movie." "I'm talking to you all right, partner, and this here's the American West, ain't it? I reckon this is the lingo used round these here parts."
"Not anymore," Case said. The creature raised its antenna, and when it spoke again, it sounded like a local who had spent some years in England.
"Oh, how embarrassing. I do beg your pardon. Clearly my cultural resources are out of date. Nevertheless, can you please tell me which way is west?"
"It's that way, I think." Case laid down the log and pointed toward the mountains. Was he really speaking to a giant blue butterfly in his garden?
"Are you certain? It's rather important," the butterfly said. Case was starting to get the hang of this talking to butterfly thing.
"Are you lost?" Case inquired.
"Oh, no, I'm on an exploration. And when one is exploring, one is never lost."
And boy, do we find out about that. The whole thing of suspending knowing and going into being more comfortable with the unknown and bringing our curiosity. So off he goes onto his hero's journey. And did you have any Nederland kids around 12 years old read the book and give any feedback?
Well, actually, I had a 12-year-old editor who was a volunteer at the carousel. His name was Asher, and he was brilliant.
And he felt that Case was a very realistic character with typical woes and concerns of a 12-year-old?
Apparently. He was with this story over almost a year of development. And there were certain times when he would request changes, usually when I was using a word he considered inappropriate for print.
Oh, okay, so he had you on a short leash. Good.
You could see in the... Asher was a brilliant editor.
So off he goes. He's on his wandering in wonder journey of exploration. Where does he go and what cultures does he meet? Because in the beginning of the book, we get a geography lesson, which is absolutely fabulous. And he goes to various countries and cultures on his quest to save humanity.
Right. Well, the first stop... He's following a set of clues, I should say, that began with an odd yellow mark on his mother's map of the world. And the yellow mark was in a place called Siem Reap, which is in Cambodia, very near the Angkor Wat Kingdom, the ruins of the ancient Angkor Kingdom and the Angkor Wat Temple. On the way, they fly low over Japan to observe the peace sculpture commemorating the Holocaust. One of the things I've tried to do in this book is not pretend that 12-year-olds or 9 to 12-year-olds shouldn't know some of the bad things that have happened in the world and how wonder might have changed those scenarios had it been stronger. Anyway, their first destination is Angkor Wat. And they stop on the way at a place called the Russian Market, which is a real place and fascinating place. And Case has some fried cockroaches. Gross food is a theme throughout the book. My daughters used to love it when I made up eyeball soup, etc. And at Angkor Wat, we have Case practically being lunch for a giant naga. And in ancient Hindu culture, a naga were giant cobras who guarded the temples. And there he meets Mira, the namesake of the butterfly. And my puppy, by the way, who really is a rascal. So that fit real well. And Mira is a skinny, angry 12-year-old Rohingya refugee survivor. The book eventually Case finally finds out what happened to Mira's family. And it's one of my favorite parts of the book, but it's one of the hardest to read because it's based on a real massacre of a real village called Tulatoli in Myanmar. So now they are a group of four because Mira also has a wonder keeper. So we have two wonder keepers, giant butterflies, and Mira and Case. And from there they fly on to Myanmar, which is where the Rohingya still live, but many of them have been chased out of the country by the Burmese army and local militias.
I love the way that she eventually softens. I enjoy the way her character develops. We see her transformation, and it's very believable. Like all transformations, it's never a straight line. And so, but she and Case work out an understanding and a respect that really is very tender to see develop. Considering that Case had to deal with a bully, to have somebody as strong as Mira, knife-wielding that she was, is rather interesting to see him resolve some of the many things he has to resolve.
Yeah, Mira had a long way to go. And Case, of course, didn't quite know how to handle such a person. And one of the things I enjoyed the most was to put those two more together as they went on. There's another passage that relates to that relationship.
Let's have a listen.
In this scene, the four wonder buddies have landed for the night on the border of Myanmar. And Mira, understandably, wants nothing to do with Myanmar and its Buddhist population that annihilated her village. Case saw Mira pull the knife partway out of its scabbard. He sensed the loathing burning in her heart. "Which country are we in, Burma or Myanmar?" Case asked. "Stupid boy," Mira snorted. "Burma, Myanmar, same cursed country." She shoved the knife hard into its sheath. And Flinder says, "We're still on Thai soil, Case." And Case, "Oh, right." Flinder and Sebastian set about foraging for dinner. Case sat next to Mira on a fallen log overlooking Myanmar. To his surprise, she didn't stand up and walk away. "Mira, do you have carousels where you live?" The girl said, "Stupid boy," with her entire body, but remained silent. "Well, we have one in Netherland, the town where I live in America. It's in the mountains, but like these, but lots higher. Have you ever seen snow?" Case thought Mira might kill him with her glare if she could, so he resolved not to ask her any more questions. "Anyway, a carousel is this big round thing." Case paused to convert feet to meters. "About 12 meters across. It has kind of a ring-shaped wooden floor and a bunch of machinery on the inside that makes it all spin around." To his surprise, Case thought Mira seemed to be listening. "But the coolest thing are the animals." Mira turned to him and raised an eyebrow. "They're not real animals. They're carved out of wood and painted. All kinds of animals, pretty much life-size. There's a lion and a giraffe, a bear, a moose, a gorilla, an elephant." "I know elephants," Mira said softly and turned away. "An elephant and a deer and a dragon and a pony and a chicken." "We used to have chickens. And a cheetah and birds and a dolphin and so many others, and they're so beautiful, Mira. You wouldn't believe your eyes." My grandpa carved all of them and painted them too. The colors sparkle under hundreds of little lights above, and there's music. There's something called a band organ. It's a big wooden box with mechanical instruments inside. It's like hearing 100 musicians playing a song, but there's nobody in there. And when Gramps turns the carousel on and it starts to spin around to the music, the animals move up and down, so you're going around and up and down at the same time. It's magical, Mira. I know you would love to ride it.
It sounds like a waste of time, Mira said.
Yes, that's exactly what it is, or would be if it weren't for the wonder. It has the power that Sebastian has spoken of. Sebastian is her wonder keeper.
Oh, yes. Gramps called it his wonder machine. You should see the looks of the children's faces when they ride it. When the carousel spins, their eyes open up as wide as you can imagine. Gramps says that some of them, he can see the light of wonder flowing into their eyes. He tried to teach me to see it, and sometimes I thought I actually saw light. And you want to know the funny thing? I was pretty sure I could see it best in the eyes of kids with disabilities. They couldn't talk or walk or sometimes even eat, but they sure had a powerful sense of wonder. Is that why Flinder chose you? Because you could see this light?
Case had to stop and think a moment. Well, now that you mention it, maybe it was.
Silence settled over the log like a cloud. Finally, Mira spoke, not with anger, but as from another place. I knew wonder once.
There's just so many messages. These characters are out to protect wonder and use it for the forces of good. We understand that it conquers greed that lurks in the shadows. And it's really the seed of creation, a life-giving force that's to be nurtured along with the truth. And that human history is an ebb and flow of times of light and shadow. And fear and hate kill wonder, and greed and suspicion are its opponent, if you will. And so they go to great battles, of course. I wonder if you could read the bottom of 91-92.
Yes, in this scene, Case and Mira are learning from Flinder and Sebastian, who have been protectors of wonder for no one knows how long, to explain why wonder is so important. Case says, I don't understand. I get that wonder is important and all, but why fight over it? Case, Flinder paused, what would you say if I told you that wonder is the most powerful force in the world? Mira's back straightened. At least she doesn't get this either, Case thought.
I'd say you must be a little nuts. Wonder isn't powerful. It's just something people do when they don't have anything else to do. It doesn't do anything. Armies are powerful.
So most people believe, Flinder said. But everything good in the world begins the moment a child wonders about something.
Case shook his head. I don't understand how any of this has anything to do with power.
Shut up, boy, Mira snapped. Let him finish.
You see, Flinder continued, when a child sees something that touches the wonder in him, he becomes curious. If this wonder is strong enough, he will explore this new thing. Nothing can keep him from it. If he is a good explorer, he will discover new truths about it. He will learn, and his imagination will soar. But most important, he will learn to discover new mysteries to explore that he never could have imagined before.
Like the village on stilts? Case asked.
Exactly like that. And unless the Wonder Eaters find him distracted by some nonsense and suck the wonder out of him, he will continue to wonder all of his life. This is how a child grows. This is how civilization grows. Wonder is what took mankind to the moon. So you see, the most delicate thing in the world is also the most powerful. More powerful, even than armies.
Case heard Gramps' words again. Guard your wonder, son. And they started to make sense.
The natural curiosity of children and their desire to ask questions and to learn. This is the key to the survival of all humanity, Sebastian said. We are here to protect it,
and to help it grow. Mira gazed silently into the green grass in front of her.
What's a wonder eater? Case asked, partly to break the silence.
We'll get to that, Flinders said.
Yeah, we get so many great messages snickled in there, but certainly the value of wonder in our lives is a major theme throughout the book, and cautionary tale of what greed and cynicism can do, and fear and hate, taken to the extreme with your four examples of genocides. An ambitious goal for a fantasy book written for middle schoolers. There's also a message there about cell phones and the value of limiting distractions in the world and the power of their pull. I found that particularly important these days when we're talking about how much Instagram is good for kids these age, for example. The book puts aside the cell phone pretty early in the adventure, and you feel Case's kind of pull or concern that he would be detached, and yet, of course, he survives very nicely. I really enjoyed that theme.
Yeah, you know, I had to be very careful. I'm a Luddite by nature, and I had to be very careful not to make screens the bad guys. Of course, it's just a tool.
I also like your mention of the value of the libraries. We encounter a sacred library, and you get the sense that information and knowledge has a long lifespan.
Yeah, I love the library. That's all based on a lot of research. There's a holy city, once with 10,000 temples, in a place called Bagan in Myanmar. I worked in Myanmar on and off for 4 years and explored the temple complex pretty thoroughly. And there is a place there called the Pitaka Taik. It really exists, and my daughter and I explored it quite thoroughly, and it's reproduced in the book as accurately as we could. The Pitakas are sets of 30 chests of manuscripts by the Buddha. Legend has it that in Bagan there existed a set of these Pitakas in this lost library. Pitaka is the manuscripts, Taik is library, so Pitaka Taik is the name of the library. And a lovely, I like him anyway, a lovely little novice monk helps them to discover the library. The little monk, his name is Ko Yin. Ko Yin is a Buddhist, of course, and he is a refugee from a cyclone that occurred maybe a decade ago in Myanmar, and many, many of those orphaned children went to be monks because it was the only place that they had. In fact, there's an organization here in Netherlands called the Mountain Forum for Peace, and they helped I and some colleagues raise money to house about 40 orphans after that cyclone, so it was quite a personal
subject with me.
Oh, wow, that's something.
So in this scene, Case, Mira, Flinder, and Sebastian have found the secret opening to the Pitaka Taik, thanks to Flinders' compound eyes, and they have opened the door, and they are just about to enter. Most of the chamber remained in darkness. "Anybody got a match?" Case asked playfully.
"Well, as a matter of fact," said Flinder, as he and Sebastian lowered their antenna, the knobs on their tips began to glow softly, imperceptibly at first, with a blue-green light, then brightly enough to make out the dimensions of the chamber. Case reckoned that it was about 20 feet on each side, about the same size as his room back home. Red dust covered the floor, and their footsteps revealed fine white plaster underneath. The walls were mostly blackened with age and absorbed the light so efficiently that in some spots it looked as if there was no wall at all. A glimmer on one side of the chamber drew Ko Yin's attention. As if approaching a pride of lions, he stepped cautiously in its direction.
"Mr. Flinder, please, could I have more light here?"
Flinder positioned his antenna above Ko Yin. The boy did not speak. Case thought he heard a little gasp, like a peep. They all gathered round Ko Yin, and in that perfect moment of awe,
Tucked into cubbyholes carved into the plaster walls were chests, golden chests with golden lids encrusted with rubies. Case counted. There are 30 of them. The Patakas, Koyan whispered in an exhale. Reverently, he grasped a golden handle and lifted the lid of the closest chest. It made an almost musical creaking sound as an avalanche of dust fell to the floor of the cubby. All leaned in to see. Inside, laying in perfect order, were slats of wood about the size of a school ruler. They were decorated with gold and fine painting. Koyin reached inside and, with the care of a surgeon, lifted up one of the slats enough to reveal the palm leaf page it had protected for centuries. With his little novice fingers, tenderly he touched the etched Pali words on the page. "I have touched the sacred words of the Buddha," he whispered, as if to reassure himself that all of this was actually happening. Without warning, the chamber went dark. The dreeders swept in so suddenly and so violently that no one, including the keepers, knew what was happening.
We get so many of these themes, like climate change, you even work in there, that it's worrying to his age group, and the kids know, so why don't the adults do something about it? I found that very realistic. And the device of politics being confusing. The messages of courage and how to handle disappointment, who to know to trust, discovering your unique calling. You've got a lot in this book. These are times of stress on our wonder supply, so I found it very timely.
Thank you. It is, in fact, in the novel, and I think in reality, a time of a dearth of wonder. And I picked those issues because if you imagine adults with strong senses of wonder, could you imagine the kind of things they are doing to each other now? Can you imagine leaders letting the environment slip away if they had a strong sense of wonder? Genocide. If you had the feeling of wonder in you and it was strong, could you commit genocide? Sort of the point.
Right. Well, if you're curious to learn more about the places and creatures in the book, from baobab trees to Bagan and back, check out onwingsofwonder.com. It could be used as a teaching guide as well, because there's so much information. As I say, it's about science, geography, history, sociology. You get a boatload. And are there other passages that you wanted to read to us?
There is one.
Oh, good.
We haven't said much about the dreeders.
Well, yes, there are those.
There are those. The dreeders are not bad guys. They don't plot and they don't take joy in eating wonder, but it is all they eat, and they are always hungry. So, in a way, I think I'm trying to wonder whether most of the bad guys in the world are really just hungry.
Wounded souls?
Yeah.
Possibly?
In this scene, the party of five now, Toma, the bushman, has joined them and led them through the desert to a place called the Cave of the Chrysali. Toma is one of the last surviving bushmen, the only ones that still live the life of the bushman in the old ways, and they were the first people on earth. Very, very tragic what happened to them. So the three stood in silence. The objects were about twice his height in length. They were hanging from something like apple stems from the stone ceiling. And most wondrous of all, they were blue. Chrysali, he whispered to himself. Thousands and thousands of giant chrysali.
Thank you so much, Doug Cosper, author of On Wings of Wonder. This is Nikki Kaiser for KGNU.